Let's see. So this is a prospective talk, and in my case, that means there are no new results. Hopefully, the prospective is new, and eventually, I hope to write a note about this. And so, in that sense, it's work in progress. I guess my title is Nonlinear Diffusion to Self-Similarity: Spreading versus Shape in a Gradient Flow, and it's really it's a perspective which focuses on work of Felix Otto from a couple years ago, and from the perspective of one of my own earlier papers and also a recent paper by Carlin and Wilfried Gangbo. And I should say that my work, my view on this has been influenced by the work of many people, so I've written down a lot of names, several of whom are here, and some of whom you'll be hearing from later in the day. So, so I want to tell you a little bit about the porous medium equation, which is an equation for a function of time and space, non-negative, on, say, positive reals cross n-dimensional Euclidean space, and subject to some initial conditions. I'm thinking about the Cauchy problem, so subject to some initial conditions, U-naught. And I don't want to be too bothered about where this lives. It's certainly L1, but so let's take it to be C-infinity compactly supported. It doesn't really matter. And so Richard Hamilton, when he talks about this equation, calls it the bunny rabbit equation, because if you write it in this form, that, so you can think of U as representing the distribution of rabbits throughout Euclidean space. And what the equation tells you is that any given rabbit wants to run to free grass, to open grass. And so it looks around and it looks in the direction of decreasing concentration of rabbits. And it runs in that direction and with a speed which depends on the local concentration of rabbits. So the more rabbits are around, the faster it runs. So this is the diffusion speed. And it's an increasing function of U, provided M is bigger than 1. And that's called the porous medium equation because it has various physical applications. In particular, it's supposed to govern the penetration of fluid through a porous rock. And it was also derived in the 50s and 60s by the group of Zeldovich in the Soviet Union, who were using it to model heat conduction in a very hot plasma. And so at high temperatures, the plasma particles are moving faster, and so the heat propagates further, and at low temperatures, it propagates more slowly. So the picture of the porous medium equation is that at high temperatures, the rabbits run quickly, and at low temperatures, the rabbits run slowly. And where the temperature goes to zero, the rabbits hardly run at all. And so a typical effect that one sees in the porous medium equation is that after some time has evolved, the blob has spread, but it still has compact support. And so there are some delicacies associated with the modeling of the free boundary. And it's also interesting to look at the case where M is less than 1, and that's the case where diffusion speed decreases with concentration. And in this case, the picture is that things are diffusing slowly at high temperatures and quickly at low temperatures. And so instantaneously, what happens is that any compactly supported thing becomes, the support runs all the way to infinity at any positive time, and so you get some distribution with long tails. And this is called the fast diffusion case. And in between them is the familiar heat equation, in which the rabbits run with the same speed independent of rabbit concentration. So I mentioned that the delicacy in the porous medium case is the free boundary, and the delicacy in the fast diffusion case is that, well, in the heat equation, the tails decay exponentially fast, but as soon as m becomes less than 1, actually the tails decay only polynomially fast, and so you have only finitely many moments. And while the first equation modeled various physical things, the second equation comes up in a geometric context, where for some critical value of this power m, it models Yamabe flow, or it gives the evolution for a conformal factor for scalar curvature flow. So I tend to think of this as the geometric regime. In any case, today I will be interested only in the case m bigger than 1, but then this critical exponent. And so this is an equation in divergence form. So if you integrate it over all space, you might expect the time derivative of u to be conserved. And it will be conserved as long as the tails are decaying fast enough at infinity. And this is, in fact, the case if m is bigger than 1 minus 2 to the n. That's the case that you need in order for the finite number of moments to include the zeroth moment. So and I will take this constant to be 1 without loss of generality. Actually, I will also probably want to assume a little bit more than this. I will want to assume m is bigger than 1 minus 2 over n plus 2. And this implies that integral of u of tx, x squared, it implies finite variance. And so in this case, this evolution is taking place in the space of probability measures with finite variance. So in a space which I'll call PM or P2 of Rn. And I'm also going to be interested in this. So it's also easy to check that this equation preserves the center of mass. And so I'm often going to restrict myself to the subspace M0. which is the set of U and M, such that integral of X, U, is equal to 0 over Rn. And I will furthermore have a special interest in the subset of these centered probability measures, which consist of unit variance. So I call that set S1 because I think of it as the unit sphere. Which will become clear in a moment. And so what I'm interested in this equation is the long time behavior of the solutions. And so let me remind you briefly what we know about the heat equation, since it motivates what happens for the nonlinear equations. So in case m equals 1, there's a special solution of this equation that everyone knows, and it's e to the minus x squared over 2t, correctly normalized, the standard Gaussian. And for any other initial data, the solution is u naught convolved with the standard Gaussian. And so what one sees about this is that this tends to 0 as t goes to infinity. But as it tends to 0, it becomes more and more Gaussian-like. So shape becomes more and more Gaussian. And so people have been interested in quantifying this. How does shape become more and more Gaussian? And so in order to quantify this, let me introduce a kind of the variance, a kind of radius, which will be the for each u, I associate to u the quantity r squared, which is its variance. And I also associate to u. I also want to associate to u a sort of normalized version of u. So u of tx, u of x, let's say, let's suppress t for a second, becomes 1 over r to the n u hat of x over r. And so the point is that u hat has the same shape of u, except u in m naught implies u hat is in s1. And this is the definition of u hat. And so the claim is that u hat always will tend to this in some standard normal Gaussian as t goes to infinity. And something similar to this happens in the nonlinear case. So, what's true in the nonlinear case is there exists some rho hat on this unit sphere S1, with unit variance, such that as long as m is bigger than this critical exponent, Friedman Kamin showed 20 years ago that the normalized version of u will tend to rho hat as t goes to infinity. And in the last couple of years, several groups of authors became interested in quantifying the rate of convergence. And so this is in some respects spiritually related to the question that Keith and Asaf and Shiri were describing earlier in the week of quantifying the rate of convergence in the central limit theorem. That would correspond to that's a nonlinear version of the heat equation, if you like, but corresponds to the case m equals 1 and not m different from 1. So Jose Carrillo and Toscani in 2000, and also Dobel Del Pino and Felix Otto in 2001 showed that in this range of exponents, you can quantify the rate at which u hat tends to rho, at least in an L1 sense, and actually they use an entropy method to do this, so also in a sense of entropy. And Felix Otto, in addition to the L1 sense, introduced a second way of measuring the closeness of u hat of t to rho, and it's the Wasserstein L2 distance. So let me remind you what that is. But so one of the things that Felix Otto shows is that for any two solutions, u1 hat, u1 and u2 of the equation, if you take the normalized versions, u1 hat and u2 hat, actually he doesn't write it in quite this way, so this is a paraphrasing of his result. The Wasserstein distance between u1 hat at t and u2 hat at t is whatever it was originally divided by 1 plus t to some exponent, 1 plus alpha t to some exponent, and the exponent is alpha equals 2 minus the dimension times the nonlinearity. So in particular, in the case m equals 1, it's the square root of t in the denominator. And by the way, this exponent is sharp for translations. And although Felix gets the constant right in the inequality, for the purposes of today's talk, I don't want to worry. I want to worry about getting the exponent right, and I don't want to be too worried about the constant. But this is kind of a striking result because, first of all, it holds for all time, not just long time, but even short times, and it says that the flow is acting as a global contraction with respect to the Wasserstein L2 metric. And let me remind you what that is. So, given two probability measures with finite second moments. I want to define the distance between them, and it's easier to define the square of the distance between them. And what do I want to look at? I want to look at the set gamma of all joint measures on Rn cross Rn with fixed marginals U and V. So in other words, gamma of any Borel set cross Rn should be the integral over B of U, and gamma of Rn cross any Borel set should be the integral over B of V. And associated to each such gamma is a total cost. And this distance is defined by minimizing this cost. And it's easy to show that the infimum is attained. And so one thinks of this distance as measuring the average distance squared that you need to transport, minimum average distance squared that you need to transport the rabbits which make up the distribution U to get the rabbits that make up the distribution V, the average minimum distance transported. So that's the transportation of measures part of this talk. Oh, and I guess I should mention, I think that in at least in Felix's paper, he actually takes the second distribution to always be the Blerenblatt profile, but this restriction can be removed. So you can look at any two solutions to the equation. It's pretty clear from his method. And so that already implies that the fact that this is acting as a global contraction and the fact that the set S1 has some compactness associated with it actually can be used to show that there exists a fixed point for the flow. So a row hat follows from this contraction mapping principle. So are there any questions so far? So let me point out a few basic facts about the Wasserstein distance, which I just introduced. And the first one is, if I take two translations of the same distribution, U and U translated by V, the Wasserstein distance between them is Z, some vector in Rn. And so let me not comment further on that. But the second one has to do with the invariance property of the Wasserstein distance under dilations. And it's supposed to, it's motivated by this fact about pairs of points in Rn, which is easy to check, that the distance between x1 and x2 squared is equal to the difference between their radii squared plus 2 times the distance between their normalized their projections onto the unit sphere. Right, so this is the homework. And it's easy to check this. And basically this means that Rn is a cone. Right, the picture is, or it has a conical structure as a manifold. So this is x1 hat, and this is x1, and this is x2, and this is x2 hat sitting on the unit sphere. And you can measure the distance between these two things in terms of the distance between these two guys and the radiuses of these two fellows. And so the claim two is that the same thing holds for a pair of probability measures, provided you substitute R1 and R2 for their norms, and U1 hat and U2 hat for the angular part. And so two is also easy to check. And basically, two follows from the fact that, okay, so maybe at some point I probably want to introduce this notation, so maybe I should do it now. So if I have two measure spaces, two measurable spaces, M1, sigma 1, and a measure mu 1, and I have another measurable space, M2, sigma 2, and I have a measurable mapping, F taking M1 into M2, I can induce a measure over here using this measure here and this map by pushing forward. And, I can think of F as being a random variable, and so its distribution on M2 is what I'm after. So U2 of any set over here is U1 of the preimage of U2, or F. And so this is another example of what one means by transportation of measures. Pushing forward. And so if you want to prove so 2 follows from the fact the mapping F of XY equals R1x, R2y. gives a bijection from the set of measures U1 hat, U2 hat, onto the set of measures U1, U2. And then you check that the cost integral x minus y squared against f push forward gamma hat, where gamma hat is some measure over here. This is the change of variables formula associated with pushing forward measures. Is equal to R1x minus R2y squared d gamma. I probably got everything backwards. The hat should be over here. This is better. So this is gamma. This is integral x minus y squared d gamma. And so now you use this fact in Euclidean space, and you use the definition of the Wasserstein L2 distance to derive 2. And the third observation is that convolutions act as a contraction with respect to the Wasserstein L2 metric. So if I take any, probability measure F, and I convolve it with two other probability measures, U1 and U2, the distance goes down. And this was observed at least as early as Tanaka in 1973 and maybe earlier. And so these three facts are enough to give the correct rate of contraction for the heat equation, which, of course, one can get in a lot of other ways because it's a linear equation, so one has Fourier transforms. But just as a preview, let me point out how this scheme would work in the linear case for m equals 1, in which case alpha is supposed to be, the rate of convergence is supposed to be 2. And the claim in that case is that, let me see if I can fit it all on the same board. So the claim is this rate of convergence with exponent 1/2. And all I want to point out is that this rate of convergence actually follows from 2 and 3 very easily. So dt less than d naught over 1 plus, 2t to the 1/2. Again, I'm not going to be too careful about constants. Follows from 2 and 3 because what does the fact that the solution of the heat equation is given by convolution with the heat kernel tells me that heat flow is a contraction, perhaps not strict, but it's a contraction for the Wasserstein distance. So 3 and U of t equals U naught convolved with e to the minus x squared over 2t, etc., implies the distance between U naught, U1 naught, and U2 naught dominates the distance between U1t, U2t, and maybe it's convenient to write squares. And then the first term in the dilation part is positive, so certainly I have that this is bigger than R1t, R2t times U1 hat t, U2 hat t. And so now, as if I have an estimate for how fast R is growing, then I have an estimate for this. So this grows, and this is a constant, and so this must decay. And, well, I guess we all know how the variance grows in the heat equation, but one way to see it is that if I differentiate the variance, then this should be integral x squared du dt, and then I substitute the equation. Well, m happens to be 1 in this case, but and I do two integrations by parts. And so I get 2n times um. And in the case of the heat equation, this turns, so this gives me 2nt. And so I guess I get that R of t squared equals R naught squared plus 2nt. And yes. So R1t, R2t is bigger than 2nt. And that gives me the... never mind the one. If I'm not worried about the constants, this gives me the correct rate of convergence after I take square roots here. Okay.
Is this the optimal rate for the equation?
Never mind the constants. Yes, it is. So if I do it more carefully, then I get the correct constants as well. Or at least, say, Felix does.
Can you do exactly this one?
I haven't checked. I haven't checked with exactly this argument whether you get exactly the right constants.
Okay.
Yep.
Cases of equality in this case, where the distance by convolution is known, and easy to obtain, then you have three
convolutions. I haven't seen a discussion, so. Yeah, so... So actually, I was going to say something about the proof of three also. So, and it's not so obvious to me how one sees the cases of equality, but so the proof of three goes by one proof of three, the one I cooked up anyways, goes by expressing. Approximating U1 and U2 by, say, Dirac masses. And without loss of generality, I can take the same number of Dirac masses in each case and all with equal weights. And I locate them at points xi and yi. And in this case, the Wasserstein distance between U1 and U2, well, you might call this the nth approximation. Well, let's not worry about the approximation. So the Wasserstein distance squared is actually 1 over n times a sum of the squares of the distances for some permutation. sigma as a permutation on n letters. And now when I convolve U1 and U2 with some f, Ui convolved with f becomes 1 over n sum f minus xi. And so if I choose gamma I to be, I guess, so what do I want? I want translation by xi to be defined as the mapping z plus xi, and I want to define gamma I to be txi cross ty sigma I push forward of f. And then this thing will achieve the Wasserstein distance between f located centered at xi and f located centered at y sigma I. And it's optimal. And so it achieves the distance xi minus y sigma I given by point 1. And then you use use gamma equals 1 over n sum of the gamma i's as a test function for the distance between u1 and u2. And so the Wasserstein distance was defined as an infimum over gammas, and this is one particular gamma that competes in the infimum, and it's the one that tells you that your distance is not bigger than this. And so if you want cases of equality, then you have to observe that this gamma isn't optimal, and how can you improve it? Okay. Other questions? So, okay, so that's the linear case, but of course the linear case is simple, and the main achievement of Otto is to be able to do the same thing for the nonlinear equations. And so there are three ingredients that go into his approach to the nonlinear equations. And the first one is to observe that the space of probability measures with the Wasserstein L2 metric, it's known to be a length space, but in fact Otto observes that it has a Riemannian structure. And it's not technically a Hilbert manifold, but it has the formal aspects of being a Hilbert manifold. And the second observation is that the dynamics that we're studying represent steepest descent of a certain entropy function on this manifold. And since mass is conserved, this is basically the LM norm that we're doing steepest descent at. It was convenient for me to subtract an extra constant, which is basically 1 over m minus 1 because of the conserved mass, simply because if I take the limit m to 1 in this equation, I recover the Boltzmann entropy. But in fact, for the rest of the talk, I don't want to subtract that constant, and I prefer for the rest of the talk, I'm going to prefer to take this definition. And notice that the entropy is positive in the case of the porous medium equation, and it's negative in the case of the fast diffusion equation, but in any case, what we're going to do is flow down it because of the factor. It changes signs. And the third ingredient in Otto's argument is actually an inequality that goes back to my thesis called displacement convexity. And basically what it states is that this entropy is a geodesically convex function on the manifold of probability measures. And here's the hypothesis that m be bigger than 1 minus 1 over n. And I guess that I didn't emphasize this earlier in the talk, but I should have when I was stating these convergence results. Let me remind, I'll put the slide back up in a second, but let me remind you that the result without rates by Friedman and Kamin held for all m bigger than 1 minus 2 over n. And this rate of contraction only holds if m is bigger than 1 minus 1 over n. And so it's exactly this convexity inequality that's required. And I guess in the next two talks you'll hear about things that one can do when m is not bigger than 1 minus 1 over m. Okay, so let me tell you about the manifold of probability measures a little bit. So this is supposed to be the space of probability measures, and I prefer to take them to have centers of mass at the origin. It doesn't matter much for this part of the argument. If it's to have a Riemannian structure, I should be able to talk about tangent vectors to a curve. And so, abstractly, if I have a curve S goes to U of S in M, a tangent vector is sort of an equivalence class of curves passing through the same point. And I might denote it this way. But in order to work with them, one always needs coordinates. And so there's a familiar set of coordinates on this manifold of probability measures. Namely, one expresses US using a density with respect to Lebesgue. And so one writes US of X. DNX is in place of US. And the coordinates of the tangent vector in the tangent space in these familiar coordinates is nothing other than the partial derivative. And on the other hand, if this manifold is to be Riemannian, then I need a way of associating lengths with tangent vectors. And so for that, it's convenient to make a linear change of coordinates on the tangent space to Riemannian normal coordinates. And so this should be some linear change of variables. And it turns out that the tangent space is going to be expressible as sort of a sublf space on a weighted WRN with weight U. And the linear change of coordinates that gets you from this representation of the tangent vector to this representation of the tangent vector is you solve the equation du ds at s naught x plus divergence of u of s naught x gradient phi of x is equal to 0. Right, so for fixed s naught, this is a linear equation from phi to du ds, and I solve phi. And so why do I call this Riemannian normal coordinates? Because the length of a tangent vector at the tangent space at U naught is basically equal to a certain, well, is the length squared is phi inner product phi in this W12 space, which is defined to be integral over Rn of U of S naught gradient phi squared. So somehow this is the formal structure, and the point is that when you look for shortest paths on this Riemannian manifold, the distance between any two probability measures is actually achieved by some path, and the distance turns out to be the Wasserstein L2 distance. And moreover, the entropy turns out to be a convex function along the path. So where do we go from here? Okay. So I guess the next thing that I want to tell you is, why is the dynamic steepest descent? So this is point two. And in order to calculate steepest descent, I should look at all curves passing through whatever point I'm at, U of S naught, and I should calculate the rate of change of the entropy on such a curve. And in the familiar coordinates, it's easy to calculate the rate of change of the entropy because the entropy is some integral. And so it's an integral over Rn of the variational derivative of E with respect to U, which is some well-known thing that I don't want to write down, times the partial derivative of U with respect to S. And and then I want to sort of maximize this rate of change with respect to the length of the tangent vector du ds. And so to do that, it's convenient to go to the Riemannian normal coordinates. So this is integral over Rn de du. And let me replace du ds by phi, which involves bringing in a minus sign, divergence of u s naught grad phi. And I do a integration by parts. So everything is formal. I'm just trying to bring out the structure of the argument. So and I get a dot product between d du and d phi. And this is actually the inner product between two vectors in this tangent space. And so the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality tells me that this is always bigger than minus integral us naught grad phi squared, and which is the length of tangent vector. And so for given length of tangent vector, I want to saturate this inequality if I can. And I saturate it when phi is basically a constant times dEdu. So this is the condition for equality in Cauchy-Schwarz. And if I want to get the constant correct, then let me observe for an abstract gradient flow, dx dt equals, say, some function e on Rn. If I measure the rate of change of e at xt, I get gradient of e of xt times x dot of t. This is an inner product on Rn. And my abstract formula for a gradient flow tells me that this is minus gradient E squared. And so if I'm going to choose my tangent vector phi to be like gradient of E in this argument, then I want this to be minus gradient E squared, and so I need the constant to be plus or minus 1. And if I want the energy to decrease, then I want this term to be negative, and that means I want C to be minus 1. And so if I go back and I take phi equals minus delta E delta U in this equation, then I see that the new equation that I have is du ds equals divergence of U grad delta E delta U. And so this is sort of a general form for what a gradient flow looks like with respect to the Wasserstein L2 metric. And for the particular choice of energy functional that I've made, E is 1 over M minus 1, integral U to the M. The variational derivative of E with respect to U is M over M minus 1, U to the M minus 1. I plug this into here, and after a little bit of manipulation, I recover Laplacian of u to the m. So this is the porous medium written as a gradient flow with respect to the Wasserstein L2 metric. All right. And, okay. So now the picture is that when you're descending into a convex valley, here I go back to this model problem where E is a function on Rn. If everyone is doing steepest descent, that means everyone is heading towards the minimum in the valley. And if the valley had some curvature, then they would be heading towards the minimum with a certain rate that one can quantify. And actually, this is the point of view that Otto takes. He does a change of variables that produces exactly this picture. But there's a slightly different point of view that one can take as well. And that's the point of view that our energy has some homogeneity. So E of U is also equal to integral 1 over R to the N U hat of X over R to the nth power. And so this is something like I should multiply and divide by R to the N and do a change of variables, and then I get R to the N times 1 minus M over E of U hat. Right, so there's a certain homogeneity associated with my energy. This is also R to the 2 minus alpha. We're recalling our previous definition of E of alpha. And so the picture that I actually want to think about is I want to think about Rn or M being down here. And I want to remember this radial equality about the Wasserstein distance that tells me that I can think of M0 as being much like Rn in polar coordinates. And being so there's sort of a cone. And E is radially decreasing along these lines. Here's S1, here's U hat, here's U. E radially decreases along these lines with this homogeneity. And so what does displacement convexity tell me? Well, here's a little lemma. I state it for the case of a function on Rn, but it works for a function on any manifold, that if you do gradient flow with respect to a convex function, then your distance at time t is always smaller than it was at time 0. And this is really pretty trivial to check. So the proof is that I let f be the distance squared over 2 between any two solutions at time t, and I compute the derivative of f with respect to time, and I see that that's x of t minus y of t dot x dot t minus y dot t. And that, but if these are gradient flows, this is minus x of t minus y of t dot gradient of E minus gradient of E. And convexity of the function tells me that its gradient is monotone, and so this is non-positive. So the distance goes down. And so coming back to my picture, what I have is that any two, if I take any two initial conditions, U0 and V0, and I allow the flow to evolve, well, first of all, my radius is going to get bigger because this function is radially decreasing. And secondly, my distance between my two solutions at any subsequent time, U of t and V of t, is never going to be further apart than it was initially. And this means that if I project back onto the unit sphere, if I look at U hat of t and V hat of t, the parallax effect tells me that if I look at, if two points are a bounded distance apart and they're very far away from me, then the angle they subtend relative to the observer gets smaller and smaller. And this is exactly the rate of convergence in the, it's exactly the sharp rate of convergence in the nonlinear diffusion equation, at least the sharp exponent and not the sharp constant. And so, well, So I leave you to check as an exercise the analogous statement in Rn, the reciprocity of radial versus angular growth, that in other words, that when you have this particular homogeneity for a convex entropy defined on an open convex cone in Rn, and you have some lower bound, so actually because the sign of the energy changes when you go from the porous medium equation to the fast diffusion equation, there are two cases to consider. One is the case alpha bigger than 2 and E positive. The other one is the case alpha less than 2 and E negative. But you check that you derive bounds like this in both cases. And then you follow the same proof with the Wasserstein distance in place of the Euclidean distance using this identity for how the distance between two Wasserstein distributions are related to their variances and the distance between their projections onto the unit sphere, and you obtain the same rate of convergence for porous medium equation. All right, I guess that I'm out of time, so thank you very much for your attention. And while I'm... okay, yeah. Actually, I have a comment, if no one else does. So I have a comment. If you want to get the constants correct and not just the exponents, then you can do it, but you have to use... So I claimed before that this thing was geodesically convex. But actually, a little bit more is true, because this thing has a particular homogeneity, namely this one. And I don't remember whether I want a plus or a minus sign up here, but with the correct sign up here, this thing is concave. And if you want to get the correct constants, then you need to use this fact.
Yeah, that's laid out with 1 over 1 minus m power. That's none of the Renyi entropy.
So it's called the Renyi entropy? Okay, so I'm learning new things. Right. So this is if you want to do a cleaner job than I've done today. Right, right. So this is why I gave one reason why I gave a separate argument in M equals 1. Right. So this inequality was also somehow I wrote down at some point, at the same point I wrote down the other inequalities. So. So I have an announcement, which is that if anyone that wants to go hiking on Saturday should sign up in the lounge by 4 p.m.